Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Coming up on today's program, Burma's president welcomed at the White House in Washington, D.C., Cambodia to mark the 20th anniversary of the first elections, and Japan's nuclear watchdog refused to give go-ahead for one nuclear reactor due to safety concerns. We have this and much more, so stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. For the first time in almost 50 years, a leader from Burma has officially been welcomed at the White House in Washington, D.C. President Thein Sein held talks with Barack Obama and promised him a path of reform to Burma was more stable. But serious human rights concerns remain in the former military-ruled country, and critics fear the U.S. is moving too fast to establish a close relationship. Lisa Miller has more.
Less than 3 years after the end of military rule in Myanmar and its president, former General Thein Sein, takes a seat next to the leader of the world's most powerful democracy.
I want to welcome President Thein Sein to the United States of America and to the Oval Office.
The pace of change for Myanmar has been rapid. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi is no longer under house arrest and sits in parliament. Economic sanctions have been relaxed. And just a matter of months ago, Barack Obama visited the country, the first US president to do so.
Myanmar Nangan Minglaba.
President Obama invited the Burmese leader to Washington as a sign of support for the democratic reforms he's already made.
But what has allowed this shift in relations is the leadership that President Sein has shown in moving Myanmar down a path of both political and economic reform.
But while they met inside the White House, around 100 protesters outside argued the visit shouldn't be taking place at all, as religious violence continues to claim lives and the government faces allegations that the military still maintains too much power.
We want President Obama's attention and the world attention that he is the mastermind of genocide of Rohingyas in Burma. And also he is the sponsoring ethnic cleansing and religious violence in Burma. So we want the world to know that this guy is not a real democracy guy or not a real reformer.
So I want to say to all the Australian people, my friends, my brothers, my sisters, please help us, support us. These guys are false. These guys are false. If he could be here in White House, Milosevic is supposed to be here as well. Hitler is supposed to be here as well. You know, this is not right.
The US president acknowledged the concerns, using his meeting to issue a warning about the violence against ethnic minorities.
The displacement of people, the violence directed towards them, needs to stop, and we are prepared to work in any ways that we can with both the government of Myanmar and the international community to assure that people are getting the help that they need, but more importantly, that Their rights and their dignity is recognized over the long term.
President Thein Sein acknowledged the country faces significant challenges.
We are trying our best with our own efforts to have political and economic reforms in our country. But we will also need, along this path, we will also need the assistance and understanding from the international community, including the United States.
It's been a rapid rise in diplomacy between the two countries, but President Thein Sein also knows he needs more than symbolic gestures. Economic development is critical, and he'll use this visit to attract business to a country that many see as a lucrative, untapped market.
This past Thursday marked the 20th anniversary of the first day of voting in the UN-run elections in Cambodia. There were polls that helped secure peace after decades of war, but also set a dubious political precedent. After the collapse of the Khmer Rouge regime, Cambodia suffered further through civil war and a 10-year Vietnamese occupation. Eventually, a peace plan for Cambodia turned the country around. There was a UN-enforced ceasefire, dismantle and refugee repatriation, and eventually relatively free and fair elections with a 90% turnout. Up next, Fran Kelly speaks to Professor William Maley, the director of ANU's Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy, who was an election monitor in Cambodia 20 years ago.
I think it was a model for what could be attempted in other parts of the world if the circumstances seemed to be appropriate. And although its outcome in Cambodia itself proved to be equivocal, at least in terms of democratization, it nonetheless lubricated the process of Cambodia being reintegrated into the region, joining the Association of Southeast Asian Nations and providing opportunities for young Cambodians in particular to have a very different kind of life opportunity from that which was available either under the Khmer Rouge or during the period of Vietnamese occupation.
I'll come back to the model in a moment and what it's set for the rest of the world and in the time since. But take us back to those elections 20 years ago. What took place over that 5 days? What did you see?
Well, the most striking thing of all was that on the first morning of voting, and voting was spread over a number of days, the turnout in Phnom Penh and many other centres was simply enormous. When one went out at 6 a.m, already crowds had formed of voters in their best clothes, turning up to queue up to seize the opportunity to vote. And this was striking because there was enormous apprehension in the run-up to the vote about the possibility of attacks by spoilers on voters, which led many internationals to suspect that the initial turnout would be low, with people waiting to see what security was like on the first day before appearing to vote on the second or third. Mm. And yet the high turnout on the morning of the first day of the election, in a sense, overcame the fears and the problem of low turnout that many had feared, and a very large proportion of the electorate had actually voted by midday on the first day, and that legitimated the process as no other kind of event could have done.
It must have been so heartening, and it reminds me of what we saw in East Timor when the people turned up at the voting box and stood in long lines no matter the threats that had been made. But looking back, and you know, you were there at that time, people were frightened, and I'm sure they would have been emotional. How precarious was Cambodia, and what was its future without the UN intervention in these elections?
Well, Cambodia was in a very unenviable situation until the UNTAC mission was deployed in 1992. The Paris Accords of December 1991 had provided for the United Nations to come in as administering power to put in place a level playing field for an election, the difficulty being that one of the competitors in the election was the incumbent power holder, the Cambodian People's Party, which controlled the state of Cambodia. And it was that sense of imbalance or asymmetry on the ground which had led the other actors to be very sceptical of whether a free election could actually be held if the CPP was running the show. And the capacity for violence on the part of the different actors in Cambodia at the time, particularly both activists of the Cambodian People's Party and the Khmer Rouge in different parts of the country, had really killed off for a very long period of time the possibility of any kind of civic or civil politics. And in that sense, the arrival of the UN under the mandate given to it by the Security Council provided a whole set of new opportunities.
And Australia played a very big role in that, but perhaps, you know, the central role or the key role was that by then Foreign Minister Gareth Evans, who came up with what's called the Peace Plan, his little blue book. Can you just remind us about that?
Yes, the initial embryonic idea for what might be attempted in Cambodia was put forward by Congressman Stephen Solars in the United States, but Senator Evans, as Foreign Minister, then devoted a lot of time, effort and resources from Australia to taking this embryonic idea and carrying it through to something that was diplomatically marketable. And there were two informal meetings held in Jakarta with Australian support, which brought the Cambodian parties sufficiently together on a model of transition that these ideas could then be embodied in the Paris Accords of December 1991. And not only did Senator Evans throw his own weight behind the process, but he devoted the time of a number of key staff in the department to shuttle diplomacy to pursue this particular objective. And I think it's fair to say that without his initiative and energy, there simply wouldn't have been a process of the sort that Cambodia ultimately experienced.
And Australia did follow through. I mean, General John Sanderson was the leader of the UN, the UNTAC, the UN Transitional Authority. There was diplomats, NGOs, charities, election monitors like yourself. Is this the model that came together that's so important that lives today, international engagement, not just military intervention?
Yes. I think Cambodia was the first example of what some people have called complex peace operations, in which rather than peacekeepers simply keeping combatants apart as a confidence-building measure, there was an effort to undertake more complex endeavours, such as democratisation, refugee repatriation, and the auspicing of reconstruction. However, the Cambodian case also exposes some limitations in the way in which one might attempt that kind of activity. And so if one's going to apply that model in other places, one needs to be attentive to the specific local circumstances and also be willing to carry through with a range of follow-up reinforcements. Because if a country has taken 20 or 30 years to get into difficulty, it's probably going to take an equivalent time to get it back on its feet. And one can't simply treat a free and fair election as an exit strategy.
And I'm sure that's one of the discussions you'll be having at this conference on Thursday and Friday, where you're bringing together some of the players then. But just sticking with Cambodia, finally, it still has a way to travel. There are national elections in July, but the opposition leader, Sam Rainsy, is briefly in Australia at the moment, can't return for fear of serving a prison sentence for politically motivated convictions. Does this delegitimise the July vote before it begins, do you think?
I think it's potentially a problem. Part of the difficulty in Cambodia was that Hun Sen from the Cambodian People's Party back in 1993 continued to have effective control over some of the key instrumentalities of power in the country. And when his party came a poor second in the 1993 election, he and his associates didn't take it kindly, and they subsequently used their coercive capacity to slice away at the opposition until finally there was a coup in 1997, and in effect the party that lost the 1993 Cambodian election ran the 1998 election and predictably won it. Now that was partly a design failure of the 1992-93 mission, but it also reflected the fact that just because you have a peace operation doesn't mean that you put an end to politics, which can continue to be highly competitive and even ferocious.
Sure.
In places which have experienced a lot of difficulty.
That was Professor William Maley, who is from the Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy, who was an election monitor in Cambodia 20 years ago. Japan's nuclear watchdog has refused to give the go-ahead to commission an experiment fast-breeding reactor due to safety concerns. The Moju reactor at the Fukuoka Prefecture was closed for almost two decades after a leak and fire in 1995. The head of the Nuclear Regulatory Authority has blasted Moju's operation for its lack of safety culture, saying it deserved severe action. The decision comes as dealing with Japan's stockpile of nuclear waste has become more urgent. Karen Snowden has more.
It's been 50 years in development, but never in production. 20 years ago, an accident shut it down. Restarted in 2010, it immediately shut down again following another accident. The government-run Monju Fast Breeder Reactor sits on the central west coast just north of Kyoto. It uses plutonium instead of uranium and was meant to help deal with Japan's growing stockpile of waste to produce fuel. The Nuclear Regulatory Authority's five commissioners voted unanimously against its application to open. The operators were accused of lacking a fundamental understanding of safety and of failing to correct its many problems. Professor Andrew O'Neill, director of the Griffith University Asia Institute, says it's a bit of a surprise the watchdog was so critical of Monju.
Traditionally, the regulatory authorities in Japan have been pretty pro-nuclear in the sense that a lot of analysts have pointed to a revolving door. Essentially, those who are working for the atomic energy companies essentially going into the regulatory agency as monitoring officials. So a lot of the criticism has been that that essentially the industry has the regulatory authority, if not in its pocket, then certainly able to influence the assessments of the regulatory agency.
Is this a sign that things have changed since Fukushima?
I think it is, and I think the NRA, the Nuclear Regulatory Authority, is clearly aware of the move of the shifting political climate and the degree of risk management now, I think, that defines Japan's approach to managing its civil nuclear energy program.
Hajime Matsukubo is the International Relations Director of Tokyo's Citizens Nuclear Information Center. He says the reactor is too old, burdened with a poor record, and should be abandoned.
They had trouble on 1995 about the leakage because they have many troubles. However, they cannot improve, so the regulatory authority criticized about that.
What do you think should happen now about Monju?
We think Monju have to abandon.
Japan has 17,000 tons of spent nuclear fuel it needs to reprocess. At a cost of $20 billion and 20 years to construct, the new Rokkasho plant will open in a few months' time. It was meant to complement Monju and turn used nuclear fuel into plutonium, which Japan insists will only be used for power generation. Plutonium can also make weapons, and Andrew O'Neill says that raises concerns.
That introduces a new dimension into this, and certainly from the perspective of South Korea or China and other states in the region, you know, Japan building up large plutonium stocks, I think, has the potential to ring alarm bells in terms of possible proliferation pressures.
Is that a valid concern?
I guess it depends where you sit. You know, historically, governments have maintained a consistent line that Japan has absolutely no intentions of commencing a weapons program, and I think historically that's a pretty watertight guarantee in the sense that there's no evidence the Japanese have ever started that historically. However, if you're sitting in Seoul or Beijing or another capital in the region, the mere fact that Japan could do that if political and strategic circumstances change has to be a cause for concern.
What circumstances?
When we think of North Korea's current behaviour, I mean, clearly, you know, the North Koreans are weaponising their nuclear program. So the strategic situation is deteriorating. And the other dimension here too is Japan's increasingly tense relations with China over the East China Sea. So, you know, I think on any objective assessment, Japan's security circumstances are far from ideal. And, you know, a pessimist would argue that they are in fact deteriorating.
Papua New Guinea's government has announced plans to build a privately run maximum security prison on Manus Island. Prime Minister Peter O'Neill says it would hold prisoners serving sentences for murder, robbery, and rape. The maximum security prison will also rid serious offenders of a holiday camp mentality. From Port Moresby, Freeman Nannal reports.
Prime Minister O'Neill says many prisoners serving life sentences for murder, armed robbery and rape have escaped from some of the country's maximum prison cells recently. He says the government will build a maximum prison to be managed by a private company on PNG's Manus Island. Prime Minister O'Neill says currently the country's jails are holding both remandees and prisoners in the same cells, and convicted prisoners are influencing the remandees and minor offenders.
One of the issues that we are now looking at is to plan now with our development partners in building a maximum security facility in the country. What we have done is in many prisons throughout the country, you will know that serious offenders and serious criminals are being ousted together with the minor ones, and as a result, there is a lot of influence and contamination of behavior of kids that who are imprisoned for minor crimes are being influenced by serious criminals. So as a result, you know, we're not correcting the behavior of those can be corrected. So we believe strongly that we must now have a maximum security prison by itself so that we will remove those hardcore criminals and place them in an environment where it is totally controlled.
Prime Minister Peter O'Neill announced it when responding to questions from the member for Manus, Ronnie Knight, who wanted something to be done about the deteriorating prison system in the country. In Parliament, Mr. Knight asked the government to consider building a maximum prison on an island in his Manus province.
few weeks ago, Prime Minister expressed interest in building a maximum security prison on an isolated island, which will address the issues of mass escapes and further crimes. Such an island would need to be, one, isolated, of course, and at least 200 miles from the nearest mainland, preferably state-owned, and have access to an airstrip. Mr. Speaker, my Nigoyam electorate, mostly an Inigo group of islands, has several of these islands available, which are uninhabited and fulfill the criteria. Four of my islands, they have airstrips capable of handling light and medium aircraft. My questions are, is such a prison being seriously considered?
Prime Minister Peter O'Neill thanked the MP Ronnie Knight and also told Parliament that the government has held discussions with Mr. Knight and the Manus Governor Charlie Benjamin to build a maximum prison on an island in Manus Province.
Member for Manus Open and the Governor for Manus Province, both have now agreed that they will facilitate for an island where we can build it. So firstly, let me thank the people of Manus and Manus Province, especially the leaders who have come to the rescue of this country on many occasions, and two clear ones are now this particular one on law and order issue, and the other one is the asylum seekers. For asylum issue, Manus put up the hand and honored every aspect of the agreements that they have established with both our government and the Australian government. Now they have come up with their facility that is now going to be developed, and we will now start process of planning, and our aim is to start construction in 2014. Wherever there is a criminal that has been sentenced to life for murder or death or all the other hardcore criminals will be flown from wherever they are to direct to the island, so that we will put them in a maximum security so that they are placed under that environment where escape is not possible. So that is the ultimate aim of this government. Many a times I think we're all sick and tired of all the escapees.
Yeah.
Every time, you know, all the jails have been treated as a governor for Oro stated earlier, as an holiday camp, you know. The other thing is that some of our corrupt correctional services officers have been compromised. So, Mr. Speaker, it is a good idea that we separate all the hardcore criminals in the center where we can manage them better. So we will start with this particular maximum security as the first privately run facility in the country.
The government announced the plan after the daring escape of PNG's most wanted bank robber and rapist William Caprice with two others from the Bomana Maximum Prison outside the capital Port Moresby last Tuesday. One of the escapees was killed by police and the corrective service officers when he resisted arrest. Police have issued a stern warning to William Caprice and the other who are still on the run to surrender. The police Araki has vowed to recapture them dead or alive. Femme Nanok, Port Moresby.
And finally, conservationists in Hong Kong say a Fujian carrier, Air Pacific, is helping feed the trade in shark fin in Asia by transporting them into China. Large increases in the amount of cargo being freighted between Fiji and Hong Kong gave rise to their suspicions. The Hong Kong Shark Foundation says they've confirmed that from pilot, who know shark fin is being imported. The group isn't satisfied with Air Pacific's response to the claims and says the airline has a great opportunity to improve its image by dumping the contentious cargo. Timothy Pope has more.
A seemingly innocuous press release from the local government roused suspicion at the Hong Kong Shark Foundation. The release said that between 2009 and the end of 2012, the amount of cargo being flown from Fiji to Hong Kong had soared from 45 tons to more than 1,000. It said thanks to the deepening trade links with Fiji, the people of Hong Kong could enjoy a wide range of fishery products. That caught the attention of the Shark Foundation's Alex Hofford.
So when I read that, and the two words that jumped out at me were fishery products, that kind of set alarm bells ringing. And I know just from anecdotal evidence, I know that it's a really huge problem. And it all ends up here. And Air Pacific being the only airline that has a direct link to Hong Kong since 2009, all you have to do is put two and two together to know that fishery products, which is what shark fins are listed as on the Hong Kong government census and statistics department, the trade data, fishery products is a byword for shark fin. So I started asking around in the pilot community, and I know some pilots who hail from some Pacific Island nations who work for Cathay Pacific, and they confirmed that, yes, Air Pacific have been carrying shark fin. That's definite. Shark finning is a huge problem in Fiji, as well as in the other Pacific Island nations that are bordering Fiji, like Vanuatu and Tonga and places, and a lot of it is coming to Hong Kong through Fiji. Fiji's becoming a hub of shark fins for to supply the Asian market, which is growing all the time, and it all comes to Hong Kong, most of it bound for mainland China. About 50% of all the shark fin traded globally passes through this city.
The import of shark fin into Hong Kong or into any part of China isn't actually illegal, though, is it?
No, that's the main problem, you see. That is something that we're also trying to change here. There was a petition started up by a fellow, he's a concerned individual in Hong Kong, who started a petition to try and get the government here to put in a sale and possession ban, like following on from what's been going on in most of the states in the United States, California, New York notably, as well as Costa Rica, Ecuador, a few other Central American states, as well as a lot of Pacific Island countries and Maldives, Bahamas. You know, the growing trend globally is to be, you know, enacting sale and possession bans on shark fin in their countries because the practice is so unsustainable. And yet CITES, you know, which is the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species, is very slow to catch up to the realities on the ground, or rather in the ocean. So just because it's not illegal, it doesn't mean that it's not a very, very huge and urgent problem.
In August last year, Air Pacific announced a partnership with the Mamanuka Environment Society, helping them protect marine reserves. Alex Hofford says that doesn't stack up with what he's found.
On the one hand, they profess to be working hand in hand with the local community to protect the coral reefs in Fiji. But on the other hand, they're absolutely complicit with destroying thousands of sharks in the South Pacific, just for profit and greed.
And what was Air Pacific's reaction to your claims?
It's just a fob off, really. It was just a fob off email. We acknowledge receipt of your letter and investigating the issues you've raised, and it will get back to you shortly with a substantive response. So I tried to call them back and to send them more information, but they didn't reply.
Alex Hofford says the airline has a great opportunity to distance itself from the shark fin trade.
Hopefully they'll engage constructively, and that they're undergoing a rebranding exercise that I think they're rolling out in June. They've repainted all their planes, and so hopefully they can leave their the bad ways behind them with the old brand, and do the right thing for the marine environment, and take that on board with their newly rebranded Fiji Airways.
And with that report from Timothy Pope, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. You can catch another edition at 13 hours UTC Sunday for listeners in Southeast Asia and East Asia on 11750 kilohertz. And that's from PCJ Radio International's shortwave service, 13 hours UTC on 11750. And the presenter for that program is Andy Sennett. If you wish to listen to this program again or catch past editions, visit our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. That's www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. So until next week, bye-bye.